Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm a sociologist by training. I'm an environmental sociologist. And I'm proud to say that I am an environmentalist. And I've been black most of my life. If we talk about the environment, I think it's very important to understand that the environment is everything. And when we talk about environmental justice, the issues that I will be talking with you briefly this afternoon are issues that I've been working on for the last 20 years, and I was inspired 20 years ago, and I'm still inspired by this brave hero, Dr. King. Environmental justice for all, keeping King's legacy alive. If we define the environment, what is it? The environment is everything. It's where we live, work, play, go to school, as well as the physical and natural world. We're all environmentalists. I gave two talks this morning in class, and I asked students who are environmentalists, and that was mixed feelings. And when I went through the scenario of, if you breathe the air, if you drink the water, if you are concerned about what's in your food, if you drive a car, most of us are concerned about what happens as a result of the things that we do, our activities. So we're all environmentalists. Some of us may be still in the closet and don't know it. When we talk about this question of environmental justice means equal enforcement of environmental laws, identifying and eliminating discriminatory practices and policies, whether these practices and policies have direct impact, that are intended or unintended, it doesn't matter. When we talk about addressing disproportionate and disparate and adverse impacts that result in environmental contamination or human health impacts, we're talking about real issues. These are not issues that were somehow invented by some radical sociologist. These are real. And the most important part of environmental justice is basically getting people at the table who need to be at the table. So I'm very pleased to be in Vermont. I'm very pleased to speak to individuals and people and organization leaders and just everyday people about the environment and what we all can do. We all have a part to play. We're all part of the problem, but we can also be part of the solution. So environmental justice also means involving people and getting the most impacted at the table to speak for themselves. You know, Malcolm said, just because you sit at the table doesn't make you a diner. You have to be eating from the table to be a diner. The environmental justice movement is about creating diners. It's about creating people who have information, who can make informed decisions about their lives and the lives of their children and their community. So when we talk about this whole question of the principle of environmental justice embraces the principle that all communities have a right to equal protection of our environmental laws, our housing laws, our health laws, our transportation laws, and our civil rights laws. All these things are intertwined. When we talk about the right to breathe clean air, is that in the Constitution? Probably not. But it is a basic right. No corporation has a right to poison communities. No corporation. That is not in the Constitution. So when we talk about basic rights and we talk about privileges, just because a community happens to be poor, happens to be located on the wrong side of the track spatially, and just because it happens to be working class or a community of color, does not mean that it deserves less protection or unequal enforcement. So when we talk about this whole question, how does Dr. King's legacy relate to environmental justice? We have to understand that in 1968, Dr. King went to Memphis, Tennessee on an environmental justice mission, striking garbage workers. If you don't think garbage is an environmental issue, let the garbage workers go on strike. They have to call out the National Guard. And they did. Dr. King did not make it out of Memphis in 1968 alive. Houston, Texas, 1978, 10 years later, involving garbage, landfills, and this whole issue of siting a facility in the middle of an African-American suburban neighborhood, predominantly black, Northwood Manor, This is not a poor community. This is not a ghetto. This is a solid, middle-class, predominantly black community. Now, when I say predominantly black, that's like me saying my family is predominantly black. This is an all-black suburban community. How do we know Jim Crow did it? This company, and I'm not going to call any names, but the initials are BFI, wanted to put this landfill in the middle of this neighborhood, and they had the audacity to call the landfill, I'm sorry, sanitary landfill, and we all know that there is nothing sanitary about a landfill. They called it Whispering Pines Sanitary Landfill. I took this photograph in 1978, and my wife hired me pro bono to do the research for this lawsuit, Bean versus Southwestern Waste Management, Inc., 1978. This was the first lawsuit that was filed challenging environmental racism based on the siting of a facility. I worked for Texas Southern University, a state university. My wife sued my employer, the state of Texas. I did not have tenure, but the thing was, do the right thing. So when we talk about these issues of dumping and garbage and waste, these are environmental issues. Everybody produces waste, but everybody does not have to live where the waste is disposed. There is a direct correlation between per capita income and waste generation. However, there's an inverse relationship between where waste is disposed and income. There's not a whole lot of landfills and incinerators and garbage dumps in Beverly Hills for some reason. So when we talk about these issues, how I got involved was an accident on environmental issues. How I was able to look at, in the fourth largest city in the country, Houston, Texas, a city that was the petrochemical capital of the world, and at the same time, the African-American community was invisible. I wrote a book called Invisible Houston. I said, this should make a great title. Houston had a 500,000 African-Americans, and for some reason, they were invisible. I did a study in 1978 that was part of the lawsuit, and for my wife, who asked me, she said, Bob, I need somebody to collect data for this lawsuit. I need somebody who can work with census data, somebody who can collect the information and pinpoint where all these sites are located. I said, you need a sociologist. She said, that's what you do, right? I said, yeah. So I got drafted into this. Had no other choice but to collect data for that lawsuit. And what we found in 1979 in the Houston Solid Waste Study, and was published in Sociological Inquiry, is that from the 20s up until 1978, the city basically used two forms of waste disposal, incineration and landfilling. 100% of all the city-owned landfills, 5 out of 5, during that period of time, from the 20s up until 1978, were located in predominantly black neighborhoods. Six out of eight of the city-owned incinerators were located in predominantly black neighborhoods. 82% of all the garbage that was disposed of in the city of Houston during that period of time was disposed in predominantly black neighborhoods, even though African Americans only made up 25% of the population. That is disparate impact. That is an environmental injustice. That is a case of classic environmental racism. And it's immoral. It's illegal. And so my wife said, sue them. And she used a little more stronger words. When we look at this whole question of 1983, the birth of a whole movement. And it was born, the environmental justice movement was born in the South, the same region that gave us the birth of the civil rights movement. It is not by accident that there is a direct correlation between exploitation of land and exploitation of people. In Warren County, North Carolina, a classic case where this company got this oil that was contaminated with PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, and was trying to recycle it. The federal EPA basically banned the recycling of PCB-contaminated oil. This company opened the spigot along 14 counties in North Carolina and dumped it along the highway. The state of North, this is 1978. 1982, the North Carolina needed a place to dump this dirt that they dug up. And so they went through a very rigorous and scientific process, and they ended up picking one of the poorest counties in the state and one of the blackest counties in the state. North Carolina has 100 counties, and they picked a predominantly African-American county that is very poor. The only science involved in the selection process was political science. The people basically said no. Over 500 people were arrested. And you see that on the screen, you see students, young people, community folks lining their bodies in streets in form of this, defying these dump trucks filled with contaminated soil. And you see the North Carolina state troopers lining the streets, letting the people do this and arresting folks. When we talk about this whole question of how do we know that this is real, the first national study to document the correlation between where waste is disposed and race was not an academic institution, was not a governmental agency, was not a think tank. It was a civil rights organization, United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice. A civil rights organization documented the history and pattern. And they showed, using multivariate analysis, using sophisticated statistical techniques, that showed basically race was the most potent variable to location of landfills and hazardous waste facilities. And the director of that study was Benjamin Chavis, who was at the time director of the Commission for Racial Justice. In 1991, we got together. There were like a few of us got together and said, people of color must decide for themselves what their environment will be. And we had a summit, the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit. And at that summit, we said we have to decide for ourselves and do for ourselves and challenge those who would turn our communities into toxic wastelands. We had the summit in Washington, D.C., a big conference. Over 1,000 delegates came from all over the world, as far away as the Marshall Islands, Chile, and including communities all across the continental USA. And anytime you have a big conference and summit in Washington, you have to have a demonstration. When we talk about this whole question, we said the first principle of environmental justice is that people must speak for themselves. Their voices must be heard. Doesn't mean that you have to agree. You don't have to agree with anything that I'm saying. But the principle of environmental justice is that we are talking about creating an atmosphere where participatory democracy can prevail. And democracy is very difficult. It is not easy. It slows the process down for these companies who really want to get permits and fast-track things. In most cases, when things are fast-tracks, our rights are violated. So when we talk about doing democracy, we have to do it right. When we talk about building a movement, we're talking about building a movement that is global, not domestic. When we tighten things down here, we tighten up the regulations, we make it more difficult for things to be cited. These Lulus, locally unwanted land uses, they drive them offshore. And just this past September, the World Conference Against Racism, there was a delegation that I was with that was focusing in on environmental justice and economic justice and environmental racism. And at the World Conference in Durban, our government came and left, but we stayed. We worked, and we said that the message was very clear at the World Conference in Durban, South Africa. We want to eliminate all forms of racism and discrimination and intolerance, whether it's dealing with environment, housing, transportation, employment, voting, education, health, you name it. It's the same. I've written 10 books, and it's the same book, but don't tell anybody. When we talk about these issues, even a child knows that environmental racism is illegal. It's immoral, it's unethical, and it's unhealthy. When we pay the price for dumping on people, for not cleaning up and not preventing what can be prevented, when we allow communities to be poisoned, when we allow unequal protection, when we allow, where people to be poisoned in the workplace, when we allow chemicals to be dumped, when we allow non-sustainable development policies, and when we allow certain types of development patterns to occur, such as suburban sprawl, and this whole question of uneven development. And we talk about these issues. And so we are talking about confronting environmental racism. All of my books have nice titles, but they have great content also. When we talk about this whole question, there are some of us who really believe, and some of us have actually documented, that some of us do not have the complexion for protection. So when we talk about this question of race and class, and we talk about this question of, we have some of the best laws that are on the books, but in many cases, they are not enforced equally across the board. When we talk about this whole question of civil rights, and we talk about transportation, for example, the issue of transportation is part of the built environment. When we talk about this whole question of civil rights, it goes back to 1896 and Plessy v. Ferguson, where Plessy was told, get on the back of the bus. You know, you talk, it's 1896. It was not until Rosa Parks in 1956 talking about trying to deal with this issue of transportation segregation and transportation racism. And we talk about dismantling Jim Crow, 1954. Board of Education, Brown versus Board of Education. So when we talk about this Clean Air Act, we have great laws. Our environmental justice movement has really moved from grassroots groups and trickled all the way up to the White House. And on February 11th, 1994, President Clinton signed Executive Order 12898, the Executive Order on Environmental Justice. And that's the Oval Office. Beautiful office, great office. And the signing of an executive order was a historic event. And that even the President of the United States at the time said, we are not doing as good a job as we should in enforcing the environmental laws and the nexus between environment and civil rights laws. Breathing clean air, drinking clean water, eating food that is safe, having your kids play outside on parks that are safe and are not built on top of toxic waste dumps, having our kids attend schools that are not built on old waste sites, these are rights and not privileges. To say, if you don't like it, vote with your feet. Some of us can't vote with our feet. Some of us don't have resources. Institutional racism and discrimination in housing still prevents some of us from leaving and moving to safer and healthier environments. So when you talk about this whole question, your physical environment can be hazardous to your health. And there is no safe place. This particular sign is posted right now in a community in Georgia, in Augusta, Georgia, Hyde Park neighborhood, that was the site of a Superfund site. And after they cleaned it up, they still have these signs posted. Don't dig in the yard. It's dangerous. Can be hazardous to your health. When kids play outside, what's the job of a kid is to dig in the dirt. So even when you clean up, even when you designate a place as safe, it is still not safe. We're talking about the politics of pollution, and all communities are not created equal. Lead poisoning is a preventable disease. Lead poisoning disproportionately impacts poor children who live in urban areas, in older housing, with chipping paint, with lead dust. The problem is not a scientific problem of not having documentation of what lead does to the body, and particularly the metabolism and the education and the learning and developmental capacity of kids. We have all the documentation, but having the facts is not enough. We have to have more commitment and resolve to end the problem, to prevent it from happening, because it costs much more to deal with kids who are being sent to reformatory schools and sent to prison because of behavioral problems that result from environmental degradation of lead. It is unethical, it is immoral to have lead in housing when we could get all the lead out right now. And if Dr. King was here right now, I think he would be saying the same thing and fighting to prevent our kids from being poisoned. And some of it is not all of the industries that's doing it. Some of it is us. We are in love with our cars. We're not just in love with our cars. We're in love with SUVs. We're in love with fossil fuels. And it is killing us. It is making us sick. Air pollution is driving us insane. And the fact that we got a lot of people living in cities that's non-attainment, that is unhealthy. And this is not a black thing, people. There are a lot of white folks who's breathing dirty air and getting sick. So when we talk about building networks across race, class, and geography and space, it's about justice. Bad air hurts, and it hurts the most vulnerable population. When we talk about a kid that has asthma and is sent to the emergency room and is leaving school, out of school, falling behind, it's an educational issue. So in the issues that we're talking about, it touches all of us. It touches all of us, and so we all have to pitch in to resolve it. Even though we have great clean air here in Vermont, you pay. You are subsidizing the fact that in many cases, in areas that's polluted, your insurance rates are going higher, your taxes are going higher because of the unhealthy conditions that occur in different places across the globe. And so when we talk about this whole question of everybody produces waste and everybody produces garbage, we all have a solution. And it's not by accident. You know, the first book that I wrote about environmental racism was called dumping in Dixie. But Dixie is not just in the South. Dixie is all over. Dixie is all over. But the South, because of its historical legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and resistance to civil rights, it is not by accident that the Southern United States is the most environmentally befouled region in the country. In many places, when I was writing this book, people would tell me, I was in Institute, West Virginia, and for some reason I was ignorant of the fact that there were black people in West Virginia. Well, this company, I'm going to call names because I have tenure, Union Carbide found them and put their plant right in the middle of the black community in Institute. So when we talk about these issues of environmental discrimination and this whole question of how industry can create toxic wastelands and the toxic terror that goes on in many communities. And this is Port Arthur, Texas. This is a public housing project that is inundated 24 hours a day with petrochemicals and pollution from these plants. And the people are told their emergency response is shelter in place. Close your windows. Lock your doors. Put water on the towels to block out the fumes and pray. Now, this is not America. That's basically sentencing people to death or health disparities that will show up later on in life. And so, in many cases, poor people don't have, you know, the luxury of having central air and central heat. A lot of our windows are cracked, doors are ajar. And so, even when you shelter in place, the stuff is coming in. That is not what America is about. We have a lot of black love canals all across the country where communities are trying and fighting and struggling to get relocated from these toxic wastelands. In Pensacola, Florida, this little lady, Margaret Williams, tough as nails, take no prisoner type, ex-Marine type, retired school teachers, fought and said, we want our community relocated, not some of us, but all of us. She fought the EPA and prevailed. Understand the Rosa Parks type. Rosa Parks lives today. Dr. King lives today. When we talk about these struggles, that are going on even as I speak. This is a case that was settled, a lawsuit. This company, and I'm not going to call names. I'm going to call names now because I'm leaving this evening. In Anniston, Alabama, this company, Monsanto, poisoned this community. The community hired lawyers and experts, had to go to court. This settlement just passed April for almost $43 million settlement. This community has to be relocated, removed. People are losing their community. They're losing their friends, their neighbors. It's going to kill a lot of old elderly people because they're going to have to move into a new community, a new environment where they don't have their support system. That is not what our industrial policy should be. They're going to lose their church. It's going to have to be relocated. You can't put a community down and put the church down in a new community like this. People are going to be scattered. Their community solidarity is going to be destroyed. And we talk about this whole question of having the facts. We got lots of data. I worked on a case back in the 80s where this lead smelter is located next door, no buffer, between a public housing project. What you're looking at is a lead smelter stack and a school. It's located next to a school. And lead is doing a nasty thing for this school. And it took three studies, and it took a lawsuit, and we settled it for $26 million. But it has taken struggle. And when the EPA went in there in 1991, they went in moon suits to clean it up. This stuff is dangerous. It's killing people. We should be angry, and we should channel that anger into positive action and mobilization. That's what the environmental justice movement is about. That's what it's trying to do. And Louisiana is the toughest state right now when it comes to environmental justice. Louisiana is what Mississippi was in the 60s. It's a tough nut to crack. And there is this corridor called Cancer Alley from Baton Rouge to New Orleans where contamination is really wreaking havoc on communities. There is a middle class, solid middle class African American community called Agricultural Street Landfill Community. This is a black middle class community that is built, beautiful homes, middle class homes on top of a dump. The people want to be relocated just like the people were relocated from Love Canal. But they're fighting. Ironically, it was the Department of Housing and Urban Development that funded the development of the subdivision for this American dream of people in Louisiana, in New Orleans. But people having their lawsuits right now going on to get relocated from this particular hazardous waste site. In Louisiana, during the 30s and 40s, plantations prevailed. Sugarcane was king, and black folks worked on the plantations. In the 40s, post-World War II, the petrochemicals came in. They came in to replace the plantations. And so you find many plants now lining the Mississippi River. And one of the biggest petrochemical oil refineries is in Norco, Louisiana. And just across the street from this Shell refinery is a park. And without a doubt, every individual in Norco, Louisiana has asthma or an upper respiratory disease. Not just the children, everybody in that community. Breathing that nasty stuff, the pollution, noxious fumes, fugitive emissions from this particular plant. And so the issues that we're talking about are real. I mean, for some reason, and it's not just American companies that are doing it, it's also transnational. This is an example of another little old 75-year-old grandmother, tough as nails, Imelda West, went all the way to Tokyo, Japan, and met with the CEO of Shintech. And he's a very religious woman. And when she met with the CEO, she put the cross on him. She said, "You will not, Shintech, in the name of Jesus, locate in Convent, Louisiana." As it turns out, she organized and mobilized and worked with all kinds of community groups. Tulane law students was the lawyers. Shintech did not locate in Convent, Louisiana. It took 18 months for them to fight and fend off. But the fact is that this community is already inundated with with millions of tons of pollution. They have 12 industrial plants in this one little place, 60% unemployment. So there is no correlation between where the plants are located and workings. This is the last example. There is an example, as I speak, there is a conflict going on right now, a dispute, where this landfill company in Montgomery wants to build a sanitary landfill, a garbage dump, on the historic Selma to Montgomery Trail. In the 60s, people marched from Selma to Montgomery. Not just black people, all kinds of people. People died, not just black people. People died marching from Selma to Montgomery to get the right to vote extended to everybody. And as it turns out, this trail was declared a national treasure by President Clinton. It is a historical trail. This 54 miles of trail starts in Selma, and Selma is known for that famous stand at this bridge where black people, where John Lewis, Dr. Martin Luther King, and a whole bunch of people got bloodied at this bridge. And they want to put a garbage dump on the historic trail. That is an insult to our legacy. That is a trampling of our history. Not black history. Our history. American history was made from at that famous march. When we talk about this whole question of it's about civil rights, it's about justice and fairness, it's about human rights. There was a delegation that went in last April that went to Geneva, Switzerland, and testified at the UN Human Rights Commission that the United States is in violation of the Human Rights Convention because we still have all kinds of discrimination. And environmental racism, environmental injustice is a human rights issue. So when we talk about bringing these issues on the world stage, they are global. Environmental justice is about building nets that work, building networks. When we were in South Africa, the Black Environmental Justice Network set up a booth, and our booth was visited by all people from all over. They said, "We didn't know that there were environmental injustice in the United States. We didn't know about these are people in different parts of the world." We said that there are still issues in terms of race and class, and that poor people and working class people still get the dirty end of the stick. And so when we talk about building these networks and information dissemination, our center at Clark Atlanta University is a center that provides information and a clearinghouse on all kinds of issues. And our website is very popular. We get over 50, 60,000 hits a week on our website of individuals visiting and trying to find information on all kinds of issues. The environment is a very essential part of our lives and the lives of future generations. If we don't take care of business today, Mother Earth will rebel against us and create the dangerous weather patterns, the El Niños, the hurricanes. You know, it will fight back. And we know it's not nice to mess with Mother Nature. Thank you very much.